From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
Is there any such thing as privacy on the Internet? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Internet spying has become big business, more pervasive and far more intrusive than all but a few people know. That's from an extensive study by the Wall Street Journal, which reports that companies track users in real time so they can advertise instantly. They can learn all about you, not just your shopping interests, but your financial and medical conditions, even what you're telling your friends on social networks. Are there benefits for consumers? What are the prospects for abuse? Is there any way to opt out? Would new government rules make a difference? On Reporter's Notebook later on, shakeups at the Obama White House. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. Tracking consumers on the Internet and selling detailed profiles is a $400 million business expected to double this year. Advertisers have real-time access to whatever you're doing online. Will new privacy laws be needed to restore consumer confidence? Is there any good news about this kind of intrusion? On Reporter's Notebook at the Obama White House, is it Bill Clinton all over again? First, this news update. For the first time in history, the Constitution of the United States has been read aloud in the House of Representatives. After some discussion, Republicans agreed to make it bipartisan, and here's how it started, just after 11 this morning, with the new Speaker, Republican John Boehner, followed by Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
I now yield to the Minority Leader, the Gentlewoman from California, Ms. Pelosi.
All Article 1, Section 1, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives.
With the laborious process of introducing each reader one by one, the process took about an hour and a half. And after considerable debate, some provisions were actually left out. Jennifer Stenhauer is a congressional reporter for the New York Times. And Jennifer, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, thank you.
What did they leave out?
Well, basically, the idea was they would read the Constitution that left out any language the original that was amended, including amendments that were later amendments out, such as prohibition. And so that left lawmakers in the position of not having to talk about slaves as they were written about originally, as lesser than actual people. In other words, three-fifths of all persons as they were referred to in the original document, Article 1.
That was in order to establish number of people in each congressional district. Slaves only were counted as three-fifths of all persons. There was objection to that, particularly from Jesse Jackson, Jr., Democrat from Chicago.
Yes, he made a very interesting argument on the floor that by eliminating or editing the Constitution in that way, it was not recognizing the document as sort of a living document that had changed through, as he described it, I'm paraphrasing, the struggles of war and history. And there was a little bit of a hearty debate that occurred before the actual reading.
So what was the alleged, or not alleged, what was the stated goal of reading the Constitution for the first time in American history?
Well, in some ways, obviously, this reflects the influence of the Tea Party on the 112th Congress and the new members, the new Republicans who've been elected, who have used as part of their political theory the notion that Congress has swayed away from the Constitution and executing its duties and needs to pay closer attention to its authority granted in the Constitution. So in one sense, the notion was, let's read the Constitution, let's talk openly on the floor about what Congress actually is supposed to do and not supposed to do, what its limitations are, what its goals are, and sort of to serve as a reminder of that document and also to some degree to educate voters at home who would be paying attention and to show, to demonstrate that the body's paying attention to it.
Now, Democrats did divide the labor of reading the Constitution. How did they respond to this? Was it different from the way Republicans were taking it?
Well, there were fewer Democrats than Republicans who read, and they made a real effort to go back and forth, to carry back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. In the end, there were more Republicans there to finish up the reading. But there were many Democrats who read with a lot of enthusiasm. I suppose on some level, it did seem there were some points when the Republicans might have been more excited about this exercise. But basically, if you wanted to participate, you could participate, and those who wanted to participate really did want to participate. They thought of it as a bipartisan exercise that sort of illuminated what they were supposed to be doing.
You point out in your article in the New York Times that the reading, if you listened to it, you heard things that were very different from what you would have heard in 1776.
Well, again, that has a lot to do with both the editing of this particular version, but also, you know, the version that you may read, your pocket constitution, is different. There's sort of different kind of language, if you will. The language is living itself.
But also there were the voices of women and African Americans who weren't recognized as full citizens at the time the Constitution was written.
Oh, you're speaking of those who actually did the reading today.
Yeah.
That was actually very interesting, I think, for some people, very moving to have women and African-Americans who obviously were recognized in a very different way, the original Constitution, standing as equals with other elected officials reading the document. And I would also note that there was the one period where there was a standing ovation for the reading was when John Lewis, who is a Democrat from Georgia, who was an African-American leader in the Civil Rights Movement, read the 13th Amendment ending slavery. There was, again, a standing ovation in the chamber. Nothing else really kind of got that reaction, except not even the finish, the ending of it, of the reading, because, first of all, there weren't as many people in the chamber, but also because that seemed to really be an interesting and moving moment for those present.
All right. We'll find out in the future if this was just a historical footnote or something more. Jennifer Steinhauer with the New York Times. Thanks a lot for joining us. In a moment, is there any such thing as privacy on the Internet? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The Wall Street Journal has now published 13 stories just in the past few months on one of the fastest growing businesses on the Internet, spying on consumers. Most users have no idea how much personal information is being gathered, packaged, and sold, mainly to advertisers, without the users knowing what's going on. Scott Thurm is editor, senior editor at the Journal San Francisco Bureau. And Scott, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
First of all, when we refer to spying, we're not talking about government spying or spying of that kind at all. This is spying by companies. It's done, as far as they're concerned, openly. It's just that consumers don't know anything about it.
Right. I mean, it's done by placing computer code on your computer that tells them where you go on the Internet and sometimes tells them much about who you are.
How do they place the code on your computer?
Well, you go to a website, and that website has made deals with advertisers and groups of advertisers so that when you go to there are some on our website, on WSJ.com, and you'll get code not just from WSJ.com, but from some of these other advertising companies and groups of advertising companies that then put what are called cookies, these little text files on your computer to tell them that you've been there.
That you've been to that
site.
Now, you write at some length in all of your stories about the kind of information that's being gathered this way, and there's a lot of personal stuff that is now being packaged and sold. Give us some examples.
Well, we found examples of places where these cookies can contain information about your political views, how often you go to church, obviously your age and sex and something. Sometimes an estimate of your household income, what kind of products you may have or like. It can be rather detailed.
You can find out about your medical history this way.
They can. That's rarer, but it's happened. We found examples of it.
So there are rules then that the people who do this abide by?
Well, there are no real rules. There are some informal standards. Places where people have more or less agreed they won't go, or where most of the more responsible players don't go. I guess would be the way I'd put it. There are not many rules here. Now, the government's now looking at creating rules, partly in response to the kinds of things we've been reporting. The Federal Trade Commission, the Commerce Department, and some people on Capitol Hill are talking about creating more rules so that at least put some boundaries around what can be done and how it should be done.
Have there been abuses?
Well, I mean, to some people, the kinds of things we've been talking about are abuses, right? So, the fact that political affiliation and church attendance and, we found a site that did deal in medical issues. It was a site for where people told their own stories of this disease and that disease, and another one of these marketing companies had essentially gotten access to it and scooped up all the information that was there for its own purposes. And so, to a lot of people, that's an abuse.
What were those purposes?
Well, they were off the top of my head, I'm not 1,000% sure. I can look it up while you're talking to somebody else. My recollection is they were doing market research on behalf of other drug makers. So they were, that site, the people we found on that site were primarily writing about psychological problems, and I believe the research firm that gathered all the info was then selling it to drug makers to say, well, these are the kinds of problems that people are reporting, and these are the kinds of drugs that they're reporting using, and this is what they're saying about the efficacy of those drugs.
And I take it it's possible to monitor people in real time in order to get the advertising to them immediately before they even go off the website?
Yeah, I mean, so we found examples. We have a story where you go to, I mean, people think of cookies as something that sort of works after the fact. You've been to the site, and then they know you've been there. But what's happened is because these groups of advertisers, these advertising networks are so sophisticated, and because they deal with, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of different sites, they see you each time you're on one of those sites. And so across the things you do on the Internet, going to our site today and to WebMD tomorrow and to Honda.com the day after that and American Airlines the day after that, they begin to develop profiles of who you are and what you like. And we reported on the example of Capital One, which was – and then what they could do with that is they can then determine who you are when you first show up. So in the case of Capital One, we found they were offering people different credit cards the very first time they went to the site. So I might show up, and in a quarter of a second, they can figure out that I should get this is probably not true because I'm not in that income bracket, but I should get the really good credit card offer. But you go the same day, and they think you're a deadbeat, and so they're only going to offer you a lousy credit card offer. And they were doing that before you had established any history on the site.
In one quarter of a second.
In a quarter of a second, yeah. 250 milliseconds, they like to talk about it. But that, to you and me, that's a quarter of a second.
Scott Thurm, again, senior editor in the San Francisco Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. Jules Polonetsky is director and co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum, an industry-sponsored think tank. He's formerly chief privacy officer for AOL. Jules Polonetsky, good to have you on our program.
Delighted to be here. And, Mike, sort of background as having worked in this industry, but I think a supporter but also a critic of it, I think, may be useful. The journal has done a great job at really showing how out of control some of this environment is. But I think it's useful to start for a question with a second and say, why is all of this happening and is there any good value to it? And should we mend it instead of ending it? And I think it's useful to understand that the reason much of the web content that one sees is free, the reason there's a lot of Wall Street Journal content that's free, there's a reason there's a lot of New York Times content that's free, is because those banner ads that, lots of people don't pay that close attention to are paying the bill. And is simply showing the banner ad enough to pay the bill? Probably not. If I go to the homepage of the New York Times, I can read about Afghanistan and I can read about, the economy. those aren't great things to deliver an ad against. Advertisers want to reach users who are interested in finance, interested in cars. And so the way many of the prominent media publications online, for instance, manage to get some revenue is they work with these ad networks so that when you show up at the homepage of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, you're going to get an ad saying, this is someone in the market for a car. Now, how do they know that? They know that because at a different site, you may have searched, brand new Volvo. And as the journal has done a good job describing, that data ends up being available to choose and show that ad to you. And that's what this was for many years. What unfortunately has happened is some of these excesses that I think would make, you know, even the practical person uncomfortable, the, you know, sensitive health data, data being used not just to show you an ad, but being used by other people, you know, for other purposes in ways that you might be concerned about. So I really do think that the industry, the policymakers need to fix this before it ruins the economic model for everyone. And, you know, we end up with a situation where users are increasingly unhappy, feel tracked, feel targeted, and start blocking this themselves. You know, frankly, industry shouldn't worry about the policymakers. They ought to worry about, you know, the average user who soon will be able to use their browser to make sure they don't get these ads. So it's certainly a very timely time to kind of deal with this problem before it gets worse.
What are some of these other uses? Elaborate a little bit on this. Go beyond what we heard from Scott Thurm about the kinds of things that your information is being used for other than just providing you with a service.
Well, for a very long time, what much of the industry said is, look, you don't like this, you're getting free content. What's the worst thing that could happen? You're going to get a sports ad instead of a car ad. Or we're going to know you're male, and so we're not going to show you the ad for the feminine hygiene products. Isn't that better for your life? And so, you know, we debated the ethics and the privacy issues, but it was, you know, reasonable to say what harm is being caused. Today, unfortunately, there are folks who've gone beyond that. There was one prominent West Coast company that was marketing a product for a while. They pulled it from the market today. They analyzed your social media profile, and they came up with the conclusion that if your friends are deadbeats, you're probably not a good risk either. And so they were offering banks and credit card offers this information. Hey, screen your marketing lists, and we'll tell you who is, you know, perhaps a little riskier. Don't market to them because they're friends. Now, I got a lot of friends on Facebook. I don't want to have to worry that the next person who wants to be my friend, I got to ask them what their credit rating is because it might, you know, impact me. So that's one example. Another company, and the journal did a good job, I think, capturing this one as well, was quoted saying, well, we may not make an insurance decision based on the fact that you're a member of some group online, but, you know, if you've told us that you don't have a history of cancer and then we see you're in a cancer survivors group or the like, well, that might be interesting information to us. So, you know, Amazon, Netflix, there are companies that do a really interesting job with your data. You come there, you understand they're going to sell you more books based on what books you've read and tracking what everyone has read. And we get it. We understand it. And frankly, we end up, you know, buying things that they've recommended. We like Netflix recommending the movies we might like because we kind of get what's going on. The big challenge here is that this is this big mystery, and people feel that this is being done to them instead of for them. And so can the industry step forward a little bit, be more visible, you know, label those ads, say, hey, this ad knows stuff about you. We're trying to sell you stuff. For a long time, companies felt nervous about that. If we explain to you what's going on, you'll get nervous. We don't want to talk about the ugly sausage making that happens in the background. We'll put that in our privacy policy. Go ahead and read it. It took us 12 lawyers and, you know, a year to write it. It's probably not comprehensible, but go read it. And now you're starting to see the industry moving forward, agreeing to label the ads that are smart, that are behavioral ads, trying to do a little better, showing people how to turn it off. But a lot more needs to be done.
Okay. Jules Polonetsky, again, director, co-chair of the Future of Privacy Forum. That's an industry-sponsored think tank. Adam Lehman is chief operating officer of Lotame Solutions, Inc. That's a New York company that packages profiles of Internet users for marketing companies. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Are you more worried about government regulation or about what Jules Polonetsky just pointed out, that once users find out what's going on, they're going to try to prevent it from happening?
Not at all. I mean, we are ultimately a consumer choice company. Our whole industry is a consumer choice industry in that we are about providing better options to consumers for content and marketing. At the end of the day, we work for consumers. So, you know, as Jules alluded to, we need to continue to make the industry work better for everybody, consumers, businesses, and so that regulators feel comfortable with what's happening. But I'm not particularly concerned about consumers or about regulators, because I think the smarter people get and the more they understand about what's actually going on, the more they realize, number one, we're here to serve businesses and consumers, and there are always going to be outlier examples and situations where there are bad actors. We have laws already in place that deal with misleading conduct, that deal with fraudulent conduct, and of course people should be availing themselves of those laws where that's what's happening. But for the most part, it's pretty boring. It's pretty mundane. Even the whole approach of looking at this as spying, is looking at this as if I'm sitting behind a computer watching and saying, my God, look at what Warren just pulled up on his webpage. Unbelievable. No, I mean, this is all happening in automated ways by automated systems with anonymous data. And, you know, I know in the journal's reporting that they've tried to break down the industry distinction between anonymous and personal information and say, at the end of the day, it's all personal. But it's not. We don't collect name. We don't collect address. We don't collect telephone number. We don't collect any kind of financial identifier. We don't collect any kind of government identifier. Truly, we have no interest in any of that. At the end of the day, our interest is in serving businesses who are trying to serve their consumers. So, again, I think the concern is less around where all this will go and more around how do we educate really everyone who's interested in the issue.
Okay, we need to go to a break, and I want to do that, and then we'll go back, give our other guests a chance to comment on what you've said. But how can it be a question of consumer choice when the consumers don't know what's going on?
Education has to happen, and it will be happening increasingly. We're rolling out an industry program where it'll be perfectly clear any web page where data is being collected. That information is already available, and let's face it, the media has done a wonderful job of raising the visibility of it. So I don't think anyone is trying at this point to hide anything. And frankly, if you're a consumer online and you're making public statements, I mean, we do find it a bit ironic when you have consumers who will come in a blog post that is intended to be publicly distributed, you know, expressing their view, and then the fact that someone else will observe that in a public way and try to use that towards a commercial benefit. You know, we're just not seeing the issue.
Okay.
There.
Adam Lehman again, Chief Operating Officer of Lotame Solutions in New York, a company that packages the profiles of Internet users for marketing companies. We'll continue this conversation after we take a brief break on Reporter's Notebook. Another White House Chief of Staff who's a veteran of the Clinton administration. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, just talking with Adam Lehman of the Lotame Solutions, Inc., a company that packages profiles of Internet users for marketing companies. You mentioned the Wall Street Journal series. Let me go back to Scott Thurm, editor in San Francisco of the Wall Street Journal. The very first segment of your series on this subject, which you refer to as the business of spying on consumers, involved a situation that Lotame created, and a woman named Ashley Hayes Beatty. Tell us about that.
Well, what that particular bit of Lotame software does, we talked about these trackers that they put on the computer before. That particular Lotame representative can correct me if I'm describing this wrong, but what that particular technology does is allows them to actually track the keystrokes that you know, everything you enter on the computer. And so what they had done in that case was they had looked at what the woman had done, like when she had remarked about various movies that she had seen and what movies she liked and didn't like. And then they take that and incorporate that into these cookies that they place on the computer that into which they also mix the kinds of demographic and financial and other information that we talked about earlier. And that's that's what they had got on there. So in the case of Ms. Hayes Beatty, they knew some of her favorite movies. They knew what kinds of news she liked to read. They knew that she liked to take quizzes online. And then they had, you know, packaged all that into this one little file about her, which they, you know, sometimes sell to others for the, you know, the marketing reasons you were just talking about.
What did she say when she found out this had been done?
Well, you know, she, like many of the people we interviewed for the story, she had no idea, of course, right? Because the bottom line issue is that one of the bottom line issues is there's very little and incomplete and often no disclosure about exactly what's going on here. And so she was surprised. I mean, I'm looking at that story right now, and she, you know, she said, you know, that their profile of her was, her words now, eerily correct, and that she was a little taken aback that she had no mystery left in her. We had the woman in one of the other stories, this involved technology from a different company, not from Lotomy, we told her that the cookie identified her as a Republican, and you know, she was rather taken aback by that. So, you know, the people we interviewed across the course of the series who had these tracking technologies put on their computers generally were pretty surprised to find out, A, that they were there, and B, just how detailed and specific and often correct that they were.
Jules Polonetsky, again with the Future of Privacy Forum, do you find this abusive?
Well, I think that when people don't know what's going on, they're going to be concerned and they're going to be suspicious. But what people are finding as companies start making these profiles available, and Adam and Lotomy are, I think, among the good guys in this area, there are only a number of companies that have started doing this, is they actually will show you your profile. Google does this now. Yahoo does this. BlueTie. Most don't, but the leading companies that kind of want to step up and try to address this have started showing people, and the experience has been interesting. Google's experience, for instance, for folks who go to their ad preferences manager, which if you click through Google's privacy policy, you can find, is that of every 15 users, 10 do nothing, 4 actually adjust and tweak their profile, and 1 says, no, I don't want this, and turns it off. And so the biggest challenge here is that people don't know what's going on, and when you don't know what's going on and your information is being used, certainly it's you know, that is abusive and uncomfortable. My argument is that the answer is to bring it out of the shadow, make it more visible, be Amazon, be Netflix, make this a useful feature so that when you go to a site, when you go to the New York Times, you go to the Wall Street Journal, you go to, you know, Yahoo, you're told, hey, we're trying to sell things here, we're trying to improve your experience here. See what we have, make it better, fix it, tweak it, sell it. When you put it in that light, frankly, it ends up being useful and relevant. It's a personalized experience. When you don't know what's going on, then it is a spooky and scary experience, and you wonder what exactly is going on. So if we put people in control, I think businesses are going to find that they don't have anything to worry about. Like Adam said, people won't turn it off. Those who are making it there today are not. But right now there's a lot of fear and distrust, and let's shine a light on it, and, you know, let's be straight with people. Guess what? Most of what you're seeing, you're not paying for. Guess what? That is not a gift from heaven. There are people who need to be paid. There are, you know, computers, there are servers, you know, and here's how it works. We don't have to get into the great technical complexity, but it's not that hard to say this is a smart interaction. What you're doing here is being used to try to tailor it. You know, and again, there are sites who've made this a key feature. And, you know, when I, well, the reason I like to mention Amazon is that books are among the most sensitive things, you know, our reading habits, what we're interested in. If you come to Washington and you want to know who are the strongest privacy advocates, it's the librarians. You know, they don't want the government knowing what books you're reading. They'll fight to the death. But we're all completely comfortable, more or less, at having, you know, Amazon and some of the other sites, you know, track, and because it's part of the value equation. And the big problem has been that over the past decade, as this business model has become more complex, the consumer engagement piece of it has been completely forgotten. So it's very complicated. There are back office auctions and all kinds of sophisticated technology that in real time pull all this data and instantly, you know, can in milliseconds make a decision about who you are and what ad. But very little has been done. We started 2 years ago trying to do some research. How do you explain to users this fairly complicated stuff? And, you know, most people don't want to sit down and have a lecture, right? You're checking the weather. You're checking your email. You're not looking for a lecture on privacy now. You're not looking to read the Constitution and you know, analyze a privacy policy. So we started working on trying to design a symbol, just like when you see the recycling symbol, you know what it means. When you see, you know, handicap access, you know what it means. Can we come up with a symbol? We tested it with consumers. The industry has taken part of that symbol, has tweaked it. The challenge now is, you know, will they educate folks and say, when you see this, your data is being used for you. Otherwise, the critics are going to say, you're being tracked. I think it's a lot nicer to say, here's how your data is being used for you. And that's the challenge.
Okay. Let me go back to Adam Lehman of Lotami Solutions. You said you were interested in education. Jules Polonetsky said you're one of the good guys. How do people find out that you're doing what you do? Do they have to read through the impenetrable privacy policy in order to get the word?
Not at all. But before we get to that, I do want to address something that Scott raised. And when he said, I'm not sure if this is what happened. He said, we were involved in real-time keystroke capture. That's just wrong. That's incorrect. That's poor information. We do not do real-time keystroke capture of data and watch that as it's streaming in. And, you know, even the story that led the journal's report off, unfortunately, tipped a hand for at least industry players as to, you know, what we really viewed as the bias of it. We never look into individual profiles. We have no interest in that. Number one, our advertisers are not about targeting individual users. If you're MasterCard or, you know, any major marketer, you don't care about one user. You care about scale. That's what the advertising business is built around, millions of profiles. The only reason that they were able to build the story that they did around that one individual profile is because they brought to us her name, her browser, and really asked very specifically, you know, how could they get information that would be associated with it? And even the information is all bubbled up at a taxonomy level to high-level categories because, again, it's going to be about sports enthusiasts or film lovers or people interested in the environment.
Okay, so how do people find out that Lotami is, in fact, tracking, spying, or providing them a service by looking at their what they're doing on the internet, however you choose to regard it?
Yeah, for sure. And again, I have to take issue with the spying word.
I understand.
Yeah, and when you walk into your grocery store, is that spying? When
right, sure.
They track your purchases when you order something through an online retailer or anyone. So let's just, again, we're fighting an everyday battle.
Okay, how do we find out, though, that Lotami Solutions is, in fact, monitoring or whatever choice of words you want to make?
Yeah, for sure. How do you find out all the different players who are involved in the marketing mix in your online experience? So the way you do that, number one, as Jules said, the entire industry is rolling out a program where there will be embedded with every ad and about this symbol that you can click on and see any player in the industry who is providing either data or targeting capability, and you can click through to get to the tools available. In terms of the kinds of tools that we provide, we have a preferences manager. So if you wanted to come and see, it wouldn't be associated with your name because, again, we don't have your name. But if your browser has any general data points associated with it that are used to customize the advertising, you could see what those data points are.
How do you know to look?
How do you know to look at the
To look and find out, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about it now, and again, it's going to be through the disclosures that will
So
be
at the moment, there's no way to find out.
No, I mean, you would find it out on the websites of the publishing partners or on Lotami's website, or we have an industry association network advertising initiative.
But how would you know in the first place to go and look for Lotami? There's nothing, as I understand it, that pops up on the browser at the moment and says, hey, wait a minute, these people are checking what you're looking into.
Right, and there is something now in these disclosures. The disclosures are just being rolled out as we speak, so you can find them on certain sites.
Okay.
And, you know, over the course of the next 6 months, you'll find them more broadly. You know, and for anyone who's interested, there are wonderful tools out there. There are tools from Privacy Choice. There are tools from Better Advertising, you know, that you can download that will show you on any given site who would be collecting data on that
okay.
site.
Okay. Again, Adam Lee with Lotami Solutions. Justin Brookman is director of the Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. That's a policy organization focused on Internet civil liberties issues. He's in Las Vegas right now attending the Consumer Electronics Show, where this is a big subject. Justin Brookman, thank you very much for being on our program.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me on.
Is the effort to educate by the industry enough from your standpoint, or do you think there ought to be some kind of governmentally enforced rules and regulations governing this?
Yeah, you know, I think there absolutely has to be some sort of baseline protections put into law. I mean, it's been, the FTC and the Department of Commerce both came out with reports over the last month or so talking about online privacy, or privacy in general, not even online privacy, and talk about the evolution of privacy and how fundamentally self-regulation really hasn't worked. So the Federal Trade Commission looks at it from the consumer perspective, and you hear all the things that Scott's been talking about, this lack of transparency, not really understanding what's going on. Consumers are really haven't been well served by the current regime. The Department of Commerce kind of takes the opposite tack. They look at it from the business perspective, and they say that business actually fundamentally needs a privacy law because consumers are increasingly scared of adopting online services, and it's actually becoming a global competitiveness issue, right? To the extent that the United States doesn't have a privacy regime, other companies or other countries and people around the world are scared of sending their data to the United States because there are no protections on what companies or even government can access it. So we think at the end of the day, there really has to be some sort of common sense, flexible baseline privacy protections put into law, and we're really hopeful that's going to happen in the next Congress.
Well, we also heard from Jules Apolinetsky that when people do find out about this, 10 out of 15 don't do anything at all. Four of them do tweak the situation in some respects, and only one decides to actually sign off. So do people really care?
And those are people who see their Google profiles, and that's a good success story. And if people really don't mind, then we don't have a problem with it. We're not for or against tracking. We're certainly not against advertising. We want consumers just to have a choice and to know about what's going on. But by and large, that value proposition really hasn't been made. I mean, people don't really understand that they're being tracked in exchange for this free content. If companies want to make that offer to consumers and say, hey, we need information about you to provide better stories or better content, that's fine. We have no problem with that. By and large, that value proposition really hasn't been made. And so, I mean, you see poll after poll after poll coming out, and one came out, I think, just a couple days ago in the USA Today, where really basic behavioral advertising techniques were described to consumers and say, hey, should companies be allowed to do this? And they say, no, not at all. That's absolutely absurd. I think the USA Today story said only 30% thought that was okay, and 60-some% thought that was really bad. And then they asked the follow-up question, what about the fact that you get free content for it? And it didn't actually really fundamentally change their answer. Now, if companies, marketers who are good at marketing, want to sell this to people, say, hey, let us share your information with one or two partners in exchange for that. You can get the New York Times crosswords for free or Paul Krugman's column for free. And again, we don't have a problem with that at all. But like I said, that really hasn't been pitched to consumers that way. And so when consumers do find out about it, a lot of times they don't like it.
You don't think that regulation might, in fact, curtail what is apparently a growing industry and make free content, so-called free content, less available than it has been in the past?
Hey, I'm absolutely concerned about that, and I think everyone's concerned about that, and the Department of Commerce, who is concerned with commerce, is concerned about that, and no one wants to kill the golden goose. And again, we're not trying to say there needs to be no tracking. We just want to give consumers clear options, which they don't have right now. I mean, right now, the only law that effectively governs most privacy issues is don't lie to consumers. Not even don't tell them tell them what you're doing. Just don't lie to them. So you read these privacy policies on publisher sites, and they're like 50 paragraphs long, and there are arbitration clauses and things you would never look at. And then they might say, they don't say, we're sharing your information with Lodeme, so they can share information across sites and serve you better ads. They'll say, we may share information about you with our select third-party marketing partners in paragraph 40, but you really can't even find out. Even if you want to, pick and choose among the privacy-protected publishers, it's really hard to do so because there's no, information. Consumers don't have the choice right now. We just want to kind of, fix that market imbalance so consumers can make informed decisions about what they want to do.
Justin Brookman, again, with the Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology, currently in Las Vegas. I want to go back to Scott Thurm with the Wall Street Journal. Adam Lehman said he thought your series was biased. I'm interested in your response to that and also whether there is any effort at the moment in Congress to regulate in some way that as along the lines that Justin Brookman has suggested.
Well, obviously, we don't think the series was biased. We think we sort of laid everything out, both the practices that are going on, and the industry's point of view. And we're frankly, in various places in the story, stories reported that the view that industry says that, you know, clamping down on this kind of targeting may result in less content being available. I want to apologize for misspeaking about the particular technology that was used in that first story.
You were careful about it. You said you weren't sure you were right. So
right. Well, that was one of the ones that, you know, appeared a long time ago and wasn't one of the ones I was that intimately involved in. And that keystroke tracking was something that came up in another story in the series that where Lodamy was using that technology. You know, one of the other points that hasn't really been made here is the what we call the secondary uses of the data. I mean, we're focusing here on these targeted advertising, but one of the things I think the series revealed that wasn't really well understood before we started publishing is the markets in which these data are traded back and forth, and the secondary uses to which they're being put, and that it's not, for example, the credit card screening. Or we reported on life insurers who are considering using what they can get from online data and using that to replace some of the medical screening they do now to make their own estimate of how long you're going to live to figure out if you're a good risk for life insurance. And the political advertising, the political affiliation stuff that we reported on. And so and the social network that I think was Jules or somebody else mentioned, the social network profiling that's going on. So it's not just the advertising, the fact that I'm seeing a Honda ad and you're seeing a Cadillac ad because they think you're a better customer than I am. It's the fact that once the data are created, there are very few rules, if any rules, about what can happen to it, and it's being traded and sold in these markets. You know, we've reported for, you know, it can flash. It's like the cattle futures, you know, where it goes for, and then the going rate for a lot of this is, you know, a tenth of a cent. That's what your profile is worth on the open market for some of these data exchanges.
Let me go back to Justin Brookman very quickly because we're almost out of time here for this segment of our program. And Justin, are there other places, Europe in particular, where there are rules? And if so, what's been the impact?
Yeah, you know, Europe does have like a very strongly worded privacy regime. You know, one of the problems, and, you know, they're actually right now kind of fundamentally rethinking how they do privacy as well. You know, they have these very strong top-level principles that then they ask their 27 member countries to implement, and they do it in slightly different ways, and there's not really a lot of, you know, great enforcement of it. So, I mean, a lot of people, you know, are scared of Europe. They say, you know, Europe has these really strong rules, but no one's actually entirely sure what they mean. So it's really a good time for the U.S. to really be kind of putting forward its new privacy framework as you know, certainly Europe is revisiting what they're doing, trying to figure out, you know, how to make a good, flexible, smart framework that allows, you know, trading information as long as consumers, you know, are okay with it. You know, right now the United States just isn't a privacy leader. You know, when countries around the world are trying to figure out what kind of framework to implement, they look to Europe and they see there's been a history of protection there, and they look at the United States, and the United States in the corner is shrugging their shoulders. So, you know, this is really the time in Washington, and, you know, I don't go into a member's staff meeting without them telling me they're reading these Wall Street Journal stories. And so there's a lot of, you know, interest and excitement around the issue in Washington. I think now is the time we really need to see something passed.
Okay, we will take this subject up again on our program, and I want to thank you all in the meantime for giving us a primer on what's going on. Justin Brookman with the Privacy Project for the Center of Democracy and Technology, Adam Lehman with Lodamy Solutions, Jules Polonetsky with the Future of Privacy Forum, and Scott Thurm in San Francisco as an editor for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you all, and we look forward to talking to you again about this subject. President Obama's new chief of staff will be William Daley, brother of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, and a veteran of both Wall Street and the Clinton administration. What's the message for the second half of Obama's first term? More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Norman Olney back with To the Point in Washington. President Obama has just announced who his new chief of staff will be. Here is the President of the United States.
I am proud to announce the appointment of an experienced public servant, a devoted patriot, my friend, fellow Chicagoan, Bill Daley, to serve as my chief of staff.
Once again, Will Daley has a long history, both as the Commerce Secretary for the Clinton administration, currently is with J.P. Morgan Chase, and his appointment is part of what the Obama House, White House is calling an overhaul, with 2 years to go till the next election. Shirley Ann Warshaw is presidential scholar at Gettysburg College. She's author of The Co-Presidency of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Thank you very much for joining our program.
My great pleasure. How are you?
Good. How do you interpret this nomination of a person that the president just described as a patriot and his friend?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a very, very smart political move. It is keeping the Chicago insiders in place, which is important. It keeps his core group in place. But more importantly, he is signaling that he heard the message from the electorate in the midterms, that he realizes he needs to change his inner group, but he's changing it to please some of the centrists, for lack of a better word. More importantly, the Chamber of Commerce, who was one of the biggest attackers of the president's health care bill, has already came out applauding the decision.
What's the message you heard from the electorate? My understanding is that the line from the Democrats is the election was all about the economy.
Well, it was, absolutely. And here we have a banker with J.P. Morgan, a senior executive with J.P. Morgan, coming into the White House saying, we are going to make some corrections in the way our economic message is being delivered. And also we're signaling in the White House that we are going to work more closely, I think, with the business community. This is an executive with J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan is a very influential member of that business community.
Hasn't the president, though, taken an enormous amount of heat from the base for being too involved in the with the business community?
The base is not an issue. The base will be there for him. What he needs to do is convert some of those independents and some of those moderate Republicans that changed course in the midterms. Those are the people he needs to bring back, are the moderates and the independents. I want to add another point to your earlier question is that I think that this also shows the continued influence of Rahm Emanuel in the White House and the importance that Barack Obama looks to him for advice. Remember that Rahm Emanuel and Bill Daley are very old friends. Both of them worked very closely in the 1989 campaign for Mayor Richard Daley, Bill Daley's brother, and have maintained a long friendship. And in fact, Barack Obama isn't particularly close to Bill Daley, but Rahm Emanuel is.
What about the differences in style and approach that Emanuel and Daley will have in dealing with the Congress?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Well, first of all, the work in Congress had been divided between Bill Daley and Pete Rouse. Pete Rouse had been the deputy chief of staff, and Rahm Emanuel had been working closely with the House, Pete Rouse with the Senate. There are indications that Pete Rouse may leave, which actually brings he's actually moved up to the position of counselor to the president. We don't exactly know what his role will be, which gives Bill Daley a little more room, I think, to carve out a whole new approach as to how he deals with Congress, separate from what either Rahm Emanuel or Bill Daley had. My sense is that he will bring in a larger group, including some of the business base that he has at J.P. Morgan and other business organizations, into the deliberations on particularly economic policy. Both the Democrats and Republicans in the House yesterday with John Boehner taking over indicated it was a jobs focus.
I'm told that today, this has just happened, so we're all sort of picking up the pieces, that the president did say that Rouse has agreed to stay on as a counselor.
He's gonna be a counselor,
And Rouse got a standing ovation from the White House staff. Does that mean he's on the way out?
He acknowledged, he said publicly he was on his way out, that he wants to get out by the end of the year. So I think that he had said if asked to be chief of staff, he would have stayed. He didn't get the job, and he said, otherwise I would like to move on. So my guess is that he's burned out. He's been there 30 years in the Senate, now the White House. These people all get burned out. Time to move on. Bob Gibbs, of course, is moving on to spend more time.
Press secretary. Apparently, Daley will have a choice, a role, rather, in choosing his successor.
As he should. I mean, the chief of staff's job is to frame that White House staff. We saw that in 1994 when Podesta took over from Mac McClarty. We saw it when Donald Reagan took over the White House in the second term of the Reagan administration. This is what chiefs of staff do. They carve out a new policymaking group in the White House, and more importantly, Daley has got to carve out a message. What is the message going to be for the 2012 election? This administration has had a number of different messages in both domestic and foreign policy, and they need to have a very, very clear single message to focus the electorate on.
Very quickly, we're almost out of time. Gene Sperling, a veteran of the Clinton years, is supposedly the choice, hasn't been announced yet, to replace Larry Summers. How important is he?
Oh, absolutely critical. And this is, again, reminiscent of the Clinton administration. Domestic policy in the Clinton administration took completely a second place to economic policy when Bob Rubin took over, and then Gene Sperling, is that economic policy is far more important in the big picture than domestic policy. We hear very little about the domestic initiatives anymore. This administration, the second 2 years, will focus 100% on economic policy.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Shirley Ann Warshaw at Gettysburg College, the co-presidency of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, her latest book. Thanks for being with us. The program was produced by Christian Bordahl with Karen Radziner and Gary Scott. Our technical director is Phil Richards. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.